Ever notice how a certain place can make you feel comfortable or ill at ease? Tony Hiss has, and has written about these experiences as he wonders why we react the way we do to our cities, towns, and natural surroundings. For the past 27 years, Hiss has been a writer at The New Yorker. For the past decade, he's examined our relationship to our environment. Some of his longer pieces from The New Yorker are now part of a new book he calls The Experience of Place. Hiss grew up in Washington, D.C. and New York City. His father is Alger Hiss, the State Department official who was accused of treason at the height of the McCarthy era and spent several years in jail. Hiss says that our relationship to our surroundings needs to be discussed in the public arena because they affect us so deeply. His own awareness began as a kid in New York.
This was just after the Second World War, and because of the war and the Depression before that, New York hadn't changed very much for almost 20 years. And then suddenly the post-war boom hit, and it began to change very rapidly. And even though I was a pretty small kid, it was easy enough to see that not only the city was changing, but that as the city changed, the people were changing with it. So it's something that began to become of great interest to me. And I guess I've just been lucky enough to be able to keep my eye on it ever since, because when I got out of college, I came back to New York and went to work here. So,
has your perception of a place like Grand Central Terminal changed from the time that you were a kid to that of an adult? Does it look different, feel different to you over these years?
Well, it doesn't even really feel much smaller because it's such a vast space that it's still huge no matter what size you are when you go through it. I think it's been quite a remarkably constant experience here in New York City, except for the fact that in the last few years, there's so many homeless people and unfortunates who've had to take refuge and shelter there, but that's changed the nature of the experience somewhat.
The nature of homeless people has also changed experience with public parks, places where people, once went for recreation, now avoid both homeless and as a threatening place. What happens, in your view, when public places lose this sort of feeling of welcome and become places of ominousness?
That's a very good question, because I think a lot of it has to do, excuse me, with people's perceptions, as much as it has to do with the actual changing reality. One of the reasons Grand Central seems changed by the presence of homeless people is that it was never designed to give much comfort or succor to homeless people. It's just a space to be moved through, basically. Whereas the parks can actually be designed in a way so that the homeless people and people in need feel in comfort there. And the more people who have jobs can also feel comfortable there. But the perception changes as people see people that they feel uncomfortable with in a place they're not used to seeing them. And the perception of the danger tends to increase far faster than any actual danger.
What are your criteria for finding a place that makes you feel good to be in, that you'll find yourself lingering in?
Well, there are many things that you tend to keep track of. Is it a place that seems to beckon you forward by being approachable in the first place? It's easy to enter. You don't have to climb huge steps to get into it. Is it a place that seems, where one space seems to lead into the next, so that you're sort of drawn from one thing into another? Is it a place where you could stop and linger, perhaps in some kind of alcove or corner or next to a column where you can feel protected and yet have a chance to look out at what everyone else is doing and still remain in contact with what they're doing? It's easy enough to establish, I think, just by slowing down, keeping your eyes and ears open and seeing just how you do respond, because we're all of us doing it all the time. We often are preoccupied with whatever task we have to work on, but this seems to be going on at very much at the same time.
One of the difficulties, I think, with conveying a sense of an urban design is that non-planners, non-architects, can't really read or understand even an architectural model or a so-called architect's rendering of a site, that this confuses us, and that the reality of what is built is so much different from what it looks like on paper or there as an architectural model on a table. Is there any way that you have found in your research of the science of place that this experience can be sort of shared equally between the architect and a passenger through an architecturally designed space.
Out in your area, in the Bay Area, the technique of environmental simulation has been pioneered over the last 15, 20 years. What they do is they take simple physical models and they photograph them in a special lab using a camera that has for its lens something developed for periscopes and tanks in World War II. And this hovers over the street level of the model and crawls by at what would be walking speed if you were 2 inches tall. The films made through this camera, remarkably, seem to give you a chance to actually experience a place in advance.
You work as a staff writer for The New Yorker, and a number of your articles show up signed by you. But also you write for that anonymous chalkboard, the Talk of the Town.
That's right.
Does your writing style change? Do you feel a little looser when you write anonymously?
I don't know that I've ever asked myself that question. It seems to be very much the same kind of process, actually. You're trying to put yourself into the reader's situation. I found it very good training for many years to write Talk of the Town stories because you had to concentrate on the words since no one was going to be able to recognize you from your signature.
With Rogers E.M. Whitaker, you wrote a book, All Aboard with E.M. Frimbo. E.M. Frimbo was a nom de train.
That's
for
right.
Rogers Whitaker. Would you ride along with him in these train rides?
Oh, yes, often. Although I was far behind him because he logged something like 3 million miles on trains in his career. He was one of the founding editors and mentors at The New Yorker, sort of one of the last surviving remnants of the roundtable crowd from the Algonquin, an extraordinary man in many ways. He edited about a third of the magazine for many years, wrote their nightclub reviews, wrote an Ivy League football column decades after most newspapers had given up such a column.
What did he teach you about riding trains?
Oh, about riding trains? Mm-hmm. I think that was very much part of my education in how the way you experience a place affects what you think of yourself, who you think you are, what you feel connected to, what you feel cut off from. Because trains take so much of the effort when they're running properly out of getting from one place to another. You're free to walk about, look out big windows, and drink in your surroundings. At the same time, you feel connected to the other people around you.
The biography you wrote of your father, Alger Hiss, Laughing Last, is extremely frank for a memoir of a father by a son. What was his reaction to your book?
It was a friendly reaction. I think that he got the point of what I was trying to do, which was I kept having the feeling that so many people had so many fixed opinions about this case. Based often on just sort of automatic responses, whether they were for him or against him. And that if they could set those aside for a few minutes and try to look at the people involved, they might come to a different kind of conclusion about who was involved and what happened and why it happened.
Did your experience going through the trials, knowing what your father went through, shape your sense of place in any way?
I think that it shaped my sense of place in terms of thinking that it was very important to, I was just a kid at the time, but it was very important to know exactly where you were, because since we don't know what's going to happen next, we need to be very much alive at the time when we're here. So in that sense, it helped me. I think my father helped me in many other ways. The strength and dignity with which he went through his totally unexpected experience, I think, has been of great help to me over the years. He's a remarkable man in many ways. He's someone who likes to say that 3 years in prison is a good corrective to 3 years at Harvard. I've really never known anyone come through something with such absence of bitterness and sweetness.
Would your father take you along to Grand Central Terminal and point out sights there? Did he introduce you to places as magical experiences?
Yes. I remember going with him to the old Pennsylvania Railroad Station in New York, as well as to Grand Central and up to Vermont when I was a little boy in the summertime. I think he always had a very strong sense that where you were had a lot to do with who you were, and at the same time that it was part of people's responsibilities as citizens to make sure that places provided the kind of warmth and nutrition that people need to function, both as individuals and as members of larger society.
Tony Hiss, thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you so much.
Tony Hiss is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His book, The Experience of Place, is published by Knopf.